Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. Our guest speaker will be Penny Coleman, a faculty member at Teachers College Columbia University and author of Where the Action Was, Women War Correspondents in World War II, Toilets, Bathtubs, Sinks, and Sewers, A History of the Bathroom, and her latest book, which is also the title of her talk, Selected Writings on Writing, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, A Friendship That Changed the World. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 27, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Metropolitan Community College, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Barbara Velasquez, Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education at Metropolitan Community College.
We are honored to have Penny Coleman with us this evening. She writes about illustrious but not typically well-known women and a wide range of significant and intriguing topics in her award-winning books. She has taught nonfiction literature and creative writing at various colleges and universities, including The Ohio State University and Queens College, the City University of New York, where she was a distinguished lecturer from 2003 to 2010. Currently, she teaches at Teachers College, Columbia University. Coleman has appeared on television and radio, including with Linda Wertheimer on Morning Edition, National Public Radio, and Book TV C-SPAN 2. This evening, she will present on writing Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, A Friendship That Changed the World, a tell-all. I know that you'll have a wonderful time, so I turn everything over to Penny Coleman.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'm just delighted to be with you all, and I want to also say to Barbara and Metropolitan Community College, your hospitality has been amazing. I actually put a note on the Facebook page for the book the day before. I left on Monday, and I'd gotten an email from Barbara in the morning asking me what I wanted for snacks. And I thought, in my room. And I thought, wow, this is a cool place I'm going to. Well, it happened that my granddaughter, my 8-year-old granddaughter, was there. So I said, Sophie, they just asked me what I want for snacks. What should I say? Ice cream and donuts. Where's the ice cream and donuts, Barbara? So I actually have developed a new presentation for tonight. I'm going to do something that I haven't done before because I'm talking about Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, A Friendship That Changed the World, from a perspective that I dearly love to talk about, which is sort of the writing process. But so I'm first going to give you an overview. I decided today to try a different thing, and you all can tell me if it works or not. That's the way writers talk. We think in terms of whether something works. So if you say, does this piece work? And then you say, oh, Penny, you blew it, or no, it worked. So, fittingly, I think the idea to write a book about friendship originated during a lunch in 2006 with Christy Ottaviano, my longtime editor, who is also a friend. We had just wrapped up our negotiations for my social history, Thanksgiving, The True Story, which, by the way, I discovered in writing that book that there are 12 competing claims for the first Thanksgiving, three of which are actively promoted or celebrated currently, and I also discovered that there is a mother of Thanksgiving, Sarah Josepha Hale, arguably one of the most, if not the most, influential magazine editors of the 19th century, editor of Godet's Ladies Magazine, who launched she grew up in New Hampshire, where there was a tradition of celebrating Thanksgiving, and so she became determined to spread the word and encourage Thanksgiving celebrations. And she was relentless with editorials and letters to commanders of ships and to governors and to regular people and to presidents. So that was a neat thing. So women's history is everywhere, Women's History Month, and of course every month of the year, right? But it turned out that Christy also, in addition to celebrating, wanted me to write a biography. We tossed around names, including Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, and parted with the understanding that I would continue brainstorming ideas. I did consider other subjects, but kept coming back to short, rotund, vivacious Elizabeth, a scintillating thinker, prolifically influential writer, fearless orator, and married mother of 7 children, and tall, angular, austere Susan, an indefatigable doer, an organizer and planner extraordinaire, principled pragmatist, and an unmarried former teacher. In particular, I was intrigued by their fascinating friendship that fueled their fierce fight for women's rights, a fight they relentlessly waged despite fierce opposition, daunting conditions, scandalous entanglements, and betrayal by their friends. Their friendship lasted 51 years, and as Susan once wrote, they were, quote, busy through every one of them, stirring up the world to recognize the rights of women. They didn't always agree, and at times they were at odds. Nevertheless, Elizabeth once wrote, quote, nothing that Susan could say or do could break my friendship with her, and I know nothing could uproot her affection for me. They met in 1851 when Elizabeth was 35 years old and Susan was 31 years old. Of course, I could have started the story there, right? Probably would have been easier. I would have cut out a lot of years. But I was curious about the differences and similarities in how they grew up. That meant I had to decide how to write about the years before they met. Should I write one chapter in which I compare and contrast their early experiences? Should I write 2 chapters, one covering Elizabeth's life, the other Susan's life until they met? I spent weeks working through this decision. Then one day, as I was studying the parallel timelines that I had written on long sheets of paper taped to the wall, I realized, and this was like one of those moments as a writer you just never forget, I realized that there were 4 time periods that encompassed significant events in the year from their birth, Elizabeth in 1815 and Susan in 1820, until they met in 1851. That was a eureka moment that enabled me to write part 1 with 8 alternating chapters that focused on first Elizabeth and then Susan. For example, chapter 1, Ah, You Should Have Been a Boy, and all of the chapters have quotes, was Elizabeth Cady Stanton from 1815 to 1832. Chapter 2, An Affectionate Family, Susan B. Anthony from 1820 when she was born to 1832. And that 1832 year, in both their lives, they were headed off for school, for boarding school. The next chapters, 3 and 4, go up from 1833 to 1839. And what happens in 1839, they both are dealing with issues with their father. Elizabeth, because her father has forbidden her to marry the man she's engaged to, Henry Stanton, and Susan, because her father has gone bankrupt in the Great Depression of 1837, and the families had to sell everything, including eyeglasses and, you know, personal items, underwear, all of these things. So that means Susan, which, although they didn't say dropped out of school, but she did have to be withdrawn from school and went to work as a teacher. Their years from their meeting through the Civil War appear in Part 2. What Elizabeth called the dark hours of woman's suffrage is covered in Part 3. Their final years, in which they go from ridicule to reverence, ostracism to embrace, are examined in Part 4. To do my research, I traveled to libraries, archives, historical societies, and sites and museums. I surveyed online sources. There are a number of sources now that have their papers online. Rochester does. There are images at the Library of Congress. I talked with knowledgeable people, including Colleen Jenkins, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, great-great-grandmother, a granddaughter. In July 2008, I undertook a 3-day, 800-mile road trip for a first-hand look at sites in New York that I was writing about, including Battenville, where Susan's childhood home still stands, Johnstown, the site of Elizabeth's birthplace, and I arrived in Seneca Falls in time for the celebration of the 160th anniversary of the Women's Rights Convention that Elizabeth had spearheaded in 1848. And if you go to my website, you'll see a picture of me standing by a statue that's in Seneca Falls called When Anthony Met Stanton. And in between them is Amelia Bloomer, who introduced them. And this was one of the other interesting, and I call these writerly decisions or challenges that I face. Having, in my mind, pulled this off of these alternating chapters, and I thought, wow, this really worked, because I found that worked. Then the next thing was, so we're starting chapter two. Reader is going to be starting chapter two. So how do I write about this meeting, this momentous meeting? Do I say, and then they met on a spring day? Or, no, you don't like that. Do I say, one day, Susan arranged to hang out on a street corner to be introduced? I mean, how do I do that? You see the issue? Like, I mean, I could just do a very straightforward thing, but wanting to keep the reader turning the page, which is, of course, always what I do. So this is another moment. You know, things had calmed down. I wasn't driving myself and everybody else crazy trying to figure out, you know, how to write about them. Now I had another crazy moment. Oh, no, how do I introduce them? So this was another moment of what do I do, what do I do, what do I do? And I'm one of these writers that it all goes on in my head. I don't write rough drafts. I don't write notes. It all goes on. You know those old-fashioned washing machine agitators that go, that, whoops, sorry. That was like it, yeah, like it just, in my head. So I'm always like distracted and all of that. And then when I get it, I'm a little bit manicky because I'm so excited. So here's how I got it. The chapter's called An Intense Attraction, Elizabeth and Susan, 1851-1853. Susan B. Anthony, now this first sentence that you're about to hear, the first two sentences, or the first three sentences that you're about to hear, prompted me zooming around my house, all four stores, saying, I got it, I got it. So you see, you don't want to live with me. But, you know, this is very exciting. So if you don't like it, don't say anything. Okay. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton had many mutual friends. You like it. Thank you. Including, see, now that was agony, but it's so simple when it comes, isn't it? It's like, oh, that was easy. Including Amy Post, Frederick Douglass, and Amelia Bloomer. Eventually, one of them was bound to introduce them. It was Amelia, who invited Susan to visit and attend an anti-slavery meeting in Seneca Falls in May 1851. The speakers were William Lloyd Garrison and George Thompson. Elizabeth, who had just given birth in February to her fourth son, Theodore Weld Stanton, known as Theo, also attended. After the meeting, Elizabeth encountered Amelia and Susan, who were standing on a street corner waiting to greet her. Amelia and Elizabeth were wearing bloomers, which they are in the statue, the new comfortable but controversial fashion of the below-the-knee length skirt worn over pants that dress reformers were promoting. Years later, Elizabeth vividly recalled her first impression of her future friend and co-adjutor and wrote, "There she stood with her good, earnest face and genial smile. I liked her thoroughly." Susan later recalled that there was an intense attraction between them. Now, this next sentence was another decision point, because usually when the story gets written, it's told as if they both embraced women's rights and off they were, right? Isn't that typically the way it is? Well, in doing my research, and I kind of thought that too, but the wonderful thing about doing research is you kind of get smarter about things. And what I discovered was that Susan did not, however, yet share Elizabeth's passionate commitment to women's rights. Aha. So this is another decision point. I found that fascinating. And I found it important for me and for the readers to write about what that was about. Like, why didn't she? Now, again, at any point, I could have just stopped there and then just got sailing off, right? And so when you're analyzing the text that you're reading, remember, everything you're reading, some writer was making decisions all along the way about what to put in, what to leave out, you know, all of this. And I'll talk more about this. Susan's lesser commitment to women's rights was a result of several factors. Now I'm shifting. So I've been writing a narrative, been telling you the story, and now I'm shifting into exposition. I'm setting you up to tell you what the second factor. So you've switched now to learn something, right? Okay. Her Quaker upbringing had inoculated her with the idea of equality between women and men. Unlike Elizabeth's father, Susan's father did not value his sons more than his daughters. Both were expected to be self-sufficient. Her parents supported her decision to leave teaching and take up reform work, including providing financial backing. As for voting, Quakers traditionally disavowed involvement in partisan politics. As pacifists, many Quaker men refused to vote as a protest against governments that engaged in wars. Another factor. Now, when I read this next paragraph, you're going to get a sense of sort of my values as an author. Because remember, I could have stopped there. Those are enough factors, right? But when you hear the next paragraph, you'll hear sort of a theme of something that's important to me. Another factor was that Susan was just beginning to be immersed in the whirlwind of political debates, stimulating conversations, and new ideas that Elizabeth had been exposed to much earlier. Recently, she had written to her father that she wanted to, quote, be associated with those whose ideas are in advance of my own, because then she would develop so much faster. So what theme do you hear there? What?
It's a hooker.
Huh?
It's a hook.
It's a
not really hooker.
Did I get it? Yeah, it's because it's sort of unusual. We've had sort of the straightforward.
Keeps you into the story.
Yeah.
Instead of it just being, this is the timeline.
Right. And this is what she cared about. But it's also telling you something about me that I've given that much visibility to the importance of ideas, of new ideas, of stimulating ideas. And I'm also saying that I think it matters that if you're immersed in an environment like it matters that you all are taking this course with this great professor, that I think that I'm telling you that I think that matters. Now, you can disagree with that. But I also am quoting Susan's words. Susan is saying that. And remember, this is a time in American history where there's just this fervor. I mean, at this time, many of these ideas, there's prison reform, abolition, you know, temperance. I mean, all of these ideas, Native American rights. And this concept of women's rights is referred to as the as yet not known. I mean, these are new ideas. Of course, Susan had experienced some of the inequalities. She herself had been paid much less than male teachers. She knew that although her mother's money provided the down payment for the farm, her name could not be on the deed. Her organization, the Daughters of Temperance, and you'll know this because you've read the first eight chapters that she started this organization, was considered merely an auxiliary to the Sons of Temperance. But unlike Elizabeth, Susan had not yet thoroughly delved into understanding the legal, social, civil, and religious status of women, and had not personally dealt with the practical difficulties of managing a household and raising children. Susan was also well aware of the other great social movements and other great social movement, anti-slavery. But of the three, anti-slavery, temperance, and women's rights, she remained most committed to her temperance work. That is where she thought she could make a difference. She soon learned otherwise. So now you want to keep reading and find out how you should. So let me fast forward that, because what happens is she goes to a Son of Temperance meeting and she thinks that she can speak. So she stands up to speak and the guy who's running it says, "You're here to listen, sit down, women don't speak." Because remember, this is a time when women aren't supposed to speak in public and certainly not in mixed company. So Susan storms out in indignation, forms a new organization, the Women's Temperance New York State League, enlists Elizabeth to be the president, because remember, they've met. So this is 1852. Enlists Elizabeth to be the president, and they hold their first meeting. And I actually, you know, have seen copies of the membership cards that they, you know, they gave, and for 50 cents you could join for a year, and Elizabeth was the president. So they have their first meeting. Elizabeth shows up in bloomers with her hair cut in a bob by a free African-American man in Seneca Falls. And she had warned Susan that she was going to write and be provocative, be inflammatory. And she said to Susan, you know, my thoughts are my own. You don't have to stand by me, but, you know, it's kind of who I am in the world. So she stands up in front. We're talking 1852. Very, very conservative. Got the blob, yeah. And she advocates for the right to divorce drunken husbands. She criticizes church women who raise money to send missionaries overseas when they should be helping the poor and the downcast. These are heretical ideas. So Susan stands beside her, though. So the meeting ends. Fast forward the next year, Susan, who's an indefatigable organizer, she's amazing, manages to get 2,000 people to join this new organization. So here's what happens. It now has over 2,000 members, thanks to Susan's hard work. Now we're in June 1853. As president, Elizabeth addressed the hotly debated issue of talking about women's rights at a temperance meeting. It is necessary, she said, because many women questioned whether women should be allowed to talk on any subject. She also raised the inflammatory divorce issue again. Then a motion was made to change the Constitution and allow men to be elected as officers. Elizabeth and Susan supported the change with the hope that the men, quote, would modestly permit women to continue the work she had so successfully begun. I know by the look on your face this next sentence won't surprise you. That was not to be. The men, with the support of many women, took over. They changed the name to the People's League and rejected any connection to women's rights. Elizabeth was defeated for re-election as president, and she refused the vice presidential position that she was offered instead. Susan refused her re-election as secretary. Together, they walked away from the organization that Susan had founded. Susan returned to her home in Rochester, disheartened and worried that Elizabeth was plunged into grief by her defeat. Not to worry, Elizabeth reassured her. She was happy to shed the responsibility and satisfied that she had brought up the divorce issue. Now, Susan, she wrote in a letter, I do beg of you to let the past be past and to waste no more powder on the Women's State Temperance Society. We have other and bigger fish to fry. And so then they're off and running. So all of that chapter is part of, you know, my decision making about, first of all, what stimulated and engaged me, about what I learned that was new, what I thought would be stimulating and engaging, and plus really informative. I mean, I think to have this idea that they both were all for women's rights and off they went sailing, when that's not the case, is really interesting, especially for those of us, you know, who think about social movements and social causes and, you know, how do we get people involved. It's sort of an interesting subject with all of that. So I think part of it is I have this mission, there's this void, and I think these are great stories, and I think the concept of the friendship, because, again, culturally, there's sort of a real stereotype about women's friendships. We see books about mean girls, and we see, mean girls, and we see cattiness and fighting, and, you know, women can't get along and they can't get work together. You know, as long as these conceptualizations and stereotypes are out there, this really shapes the way, you know, girls grow up and boys grow up, and women and men, you know, get this in the head and they make these assumptions, and they're not true. In terms of, if you look at the historical record, there are many examples. And yet with men, you know, we accept, you know, the closeness of men and their friendship and their bonding and their playing golf together and basketball together. But, you know, with women, it's limited to going shopping or doing your nails. I mean, am I speaking? What is this matching your experience? So for me, part of it was, and Elizabeth knew this. She gives a very famous speech about friendship that Elizabeth does at Susan's 70th birthday, where she talks about that. She talks about that it's been an age-old myth about women's friendships, that they can't work together, that they're going to be competitive and jealous. I mean, we've heard all of this. And yet, so I thought, well, here's a friendship that lasted 51 years under really adverse conditions. What was it? And, you know, let's take a look at this, and let's honor this, and let's value that. So I think it was a combination of that. Plus, I was sort of curious, and I've always been sort of interested that the fact that if there's any mention of women's fight for the vote, it's usually one line that says women were given the right to vote. You know, read the book. The struggle has been endless, and the opposition and the resistance is staggering. In Nebraska alone, defeat after defeat after defeat. When there was a referendum in Nebraska in 1882, a referendum that the vote was put to the men of Nebraska, Susan comes. She speaks at the newly built Boyd Opera Hall in Omaha. 7,000 people show up to hear her speak. 7,000 people come to hear Susan speak. She then goes to Lincoln. Thousands more come. Now, they had also been here before. Both Susan and Elizabeth are here in 1871. You know, they've made several trips. They've been here in 1877. So, you know, they're well known. There's been a lot of work going on. Women's suffrage has been discussed in the legislature before, but still it gets defeated again. After it was defeated in 1882, the college students at the university have the anti-suffrage have a mock funeral, and they put an effigy of Susan in the coffin to have a mock funeral. And the only upbeat part of the story is there were enough pro-suffrage students that they broke into the parade and took back the coffin and rescued Susan's effigy. But, you know, this is strong. This is intense. Elizabeth gave her first speech to the New York legislature in 1854. They were still talking to New York legislature. Susan did in 1896, at which point she wrote, "It's the last time I will do this. I'm now talking to the grandsons of men I've talked to before, and they don't even know a half of what I know." So, and they went to Congress. They started meeting in Washington and testifying before Congress. So the thing with the book that I didn't know that, is, wow, I had no idea of the massive mobilization. And it really starts with 1648, when a woman named Margaret Brent in the colony of Maryland demands two votes. So I think that was also part of it, was that, you know, we have 17% of 17 women are senators. You know, the representation of women in the political system is minuscule. And so I think that, you know, sort of knowing the story and knowing what, you know, we're up against, both for women, and, you know, women were opposed. There were anti-women, anti-men. There were pro-men, pro-women. I mean, it's not like a gender thing where you can cut it down. And there was actually a man in Nebraska, a Lucy and Erasmus Correll, C-O-R-R-E-L, who lived down in Beatrice. Were fervent supporters and really pushed another woman, and he actually got himself elected to the Kansas legislature in 1880, and he was the one that got the referendum put to the vote in 1882. So, you know, it's a complicated story that's, you know, a really, I think, worthy of kind of knowing and thinking about. Okay, so in terms of the second part, we're going to... I decided to open this part by answering two really frequent questions I have. One question that people ask me is, like, you know, how do I get my ideas? How do I write a book? You know, how does that process happen? So the top one, if you can see the arrow, it's author with an arrow going to editor. Ideas originate with me, with a writer. And a writer goes to an editor, writes a proposal, and says, I want to write this book, makes a case for it, does a marketing plan, and the editor then pitches it to everybody else, and you go to contract. That's true of my book, Toilets, Bathtubs, Sinks, and Sewers, The History of the Bathroom, that's now out in an e-book, Breaking the Chains, The Crusade of Dorothea Lynn Dix, which is my first biography, and A Woman Unafraid, The Achievements of Frances Perkins, who was Secretary of Labor from 1933 to 1945, the architect of far-ranging labor and social reform and of Social Security. The next way things happen is that an author, an editor contacts an author, which is wonderful. You all hate getting assignments, right? But I love them. Writers love getting an assignment. And that was the case with two of my books, Rosie the Riveter, Women Working on the Home Front and World War II, and Corpses, Coffins, and Crypts, A History of Burial. Editors approached me, and their idea, like with Corpses, Coffins, and Crypts, the editor wanted me to write about ghosts. She loved my book, Toilets, Bathtubs, Sinks, and Sewers. She had read it someplace and so approached me. And I said, I don't do ghosts. Although Elizabeth didn't rule them out, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, but back to so, and I had in my lifetime suffered very premature deaths of one of my brothers and my father, and I really didn't want to touch this subject, but then I became sort of a mission. I thought maybe if I wrote the book that would have helped me, so I did. And I took most of the photos of it. They're wonderful. Epitaphs in the back section. There's a lot of front and back matter in that book. That's also now out as an ebook, although the photographs are, but I'll send you the photographs. But they're epitaphs like, I told you I was sick, I'd rather be milking, I'd rather be dead in Vermont than alive in Florida. These are actual epitaphs that I found on actual graves that I photographed. And the other one was a gravestone in New Jersey that there's a recipe engraved at the top of the you can see where this one's going. So there's a recipe on the gravestone, and the message is, I told you you'd only get this recipe over my dead body. And then the third way is an interaction between an editor and a writer. So it can go three ways. And that was the case for Thanksgiving, the True Story, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. I had an idea, my editor had an idea, we went back and forth. And like Rosie is with a different editor, not all these books are, but Thanksgiving, Corpses, Thanksgiving, and Elizabeth and Susan are with the same editor. Also another one of my books, Adventurous Women, which is also out as an ebook. With the same editor. And so, you know, we sort of developed this way of being able to go back and forth and to figure things out. So the other question that I'm asked is, how long? How long does it take you to write a book? And the answer is, everybody say it, depends. It depends. There's no magic answer to that, except I can give you some dates. For Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, we had lunch in 2006. The next line is PC, research, writing, picture research, 2006 to 2009. The next line, CO, is the editor, and PC, that's us together doing copy editing, going back and forth, and that's 2009, 2010. The production takes a year, and the pub date was 5/11. So you see, this is a lengthy process. And again, it depends on the book. The editor was sort of slow in getting the manuscript back. You know, Holt got bought out by Macmillan. I mean, all kinds of things can happen. But, you know, it's a very intense and lengthy process. The other thing that I wanted to show, and this is what I was referencing, in all my teaching about writing and thinking about fiction and nonfiction and thinking from a writer's perspective, decisions writers make, this is a visual model that I developed that was published in Language Arts in 2008, and it's called A Visual Model for Analyzing Fiction and Nonfiction Texts. And the elements are decisions that writers make. The first one, whether or not to have made up material. The second one is how much information. You know, is it going to be an information? My books tend to have a lot of knowledge, a lot of information in them. The next one is structure. Is it going to be a simple structure? Is it going to be a complex structure? Rosie the Riveter has a complex structure. There are five narrative threads that I weave together by using the memories of a real-life girl who lived through that. So, and with Corpses, there's a double narrative. If you look at the table of contents, you'll see that it's organized by topic, but it's also organized chronologically. This book, of course, Elizabeth and Susan, is, you know, more of a simple. It's, you know, it's a chronological. Then the relationship between narrative and expository text. Narrative being when you're telling a story, expository meaning when you're giving information. Typical of my style, although not in Elizabeth and Susan, but is like with Corpses, Coffins, and Crypts, I tell a story that's set up. I was telling Barbara at dinner tonight that the image I always have is volleyball. My image as a writer is setting myself up. And so I set myself up with something, like a just the right sentence or a fact or an anecdote that will keep the reader moving, and then I give something. Yeah, something. It can be a sentence. It can be a story. It can be whatever. And, you know, that keeps people going. But it's a delicate balance. Now, with Elizabeth and Susan, what I did with Elizabeth and Susan is I weave them together. The expository information, you know, the details, the facts, are woven into the narrative. So it's a different... And the reason I did that is because this book... My attempt in this book was to bring them to life. This is about their voice, and I'm pretty much an invisible author in this. This is about bringing them to life and their vote and their voice, and I use quote weaving. You'll notice you'll read a sentence, and there'll be quotes, and so I use quote weaving. You'll see it in the book where I don't say, "And Elizabeth said," or "According to Susan." You know it because you've heard their voice. The other decision is how many literary devices am I going to use? I sort of even have to chuckle at myself. You know, the part that I read you about scintillating, provocative, do you remember that string of adverbs? That is not my style, really, in any of my other books. But I kind of went for it in this book. It was fun. And I'm not a big person who uses a lot of adverbs or adjectives. I use a lot of repetition. I use a lot of rhythm. Rhythm is very important in my writing. So some books I use more literary devices. Other books I don't. This book was sort of fun because I used more in that. And my editor and I are always arguing because she doesn't like repetition, and I love repetition because I think it builds momentum. I think it builds energy. I think it helps comprehension. Because why change a word just so that you don't repeat it, which means then somebody has to figure out what it means when it's not that you mean anything different. You mean the same thing. So at any rate. Then author's voice. There are two ways to find an author's voice. Now, all of this is my opinion. So your professor may go and say she doesn't know what she's talking about, but she's not frowning. So author's voice, in my mind, as a writer, because I'm talking about from a writer's perspective, mine. There are two ways. One is when the author says, "I, here I am, Penny, I," you know, like I start Corpses, Coffins, and Crypts, you know, "I got a phone from my great aunt that my uncle," okay, so you know that. The other is that you hear the author's voice in the style. Like, you're not going to read Virginia Woolf and think you're reading Penny Coleman. Because, you know, for lots of reasons, we're very different. Or even, you know, any other contemporary author. So there's a voice and a signature that comes through. And sort of typical of mine is my writing is, you know, there's a lot of rhythm in it. It's moving you forward. And I really vary sentence lengths. And, you know, that's one. Repetition is another. Unusual information, you know, that kind of what I put in is also different. It's sort of like, and I'm always wanting, oh, I didn't know that, but also being careful not to overwhelm the reader, to not overwhelm. So a lot of real careful attention to comprehension. With a pronoun and an antecedent, you'll notice in my books they're always close together, so that when you see that you don't have to say, "Now, what was, huh?" So I'm very careful about, because I pay attention to comprehension, because I'm conveying so much material. So comprehension is something I really pay attention to. Also, front and back matter. My books have a lot. Elizabeth and Susan, in the back matter, I have a chronology, places to visit, namesakes, you know, things that are named after them. And I like that. The front matter, there's a prologue, there's an author's note. But all of these are decisions that I make. And then the amount of visual material, you know, how much visual material is. And so just off the top of my head, and I can send you one of these if you want, but I can send you this article. Because it's not a definitive thing. It's, you know, it's sort of my take on what I thought. But it's a really great way. It's another way to be able to talk about text. You know, it's another form of analysis of a text. And it's also a way to begin, as you're reading a text, to learn about the writing process, because then you begin to get sort of inside what a writer's doing, and then you can kind of begin to decide, you know, what doesn't and doesn't work for you. The next thing I want to talk about is the prologue. And the issue with the prologue was, in writing the book and thinking about the audience, one of the things that I was aware of was that I would be writing to an audience that may or may not have any background information about this time in history. I also knew from my own reading that typically how this period gets written about is it's one sentence that says women didn't own their salary, they couldn't control their children, they couldn't sue in court, you know, da-da-da-da-da, couldn't, you know, married women. You know, you've seen that one sentence. And I thought, that one sentence doesn't do it. I glaze over it. I bet most people glaze over it. And there's no emotional connection with that sentence. I mean, and is it even believable? I mean, I began to wonder, if there's no emotional connection, if there's nothing that sort of resonates, and it's so detached, then why do it? If it's important for this story to have that context, which it was. So again, that was another period of how do I handle that, how do I handle that, how do I handle that? And what I ended up doing is writing a prologue. And the prologue is titled Imagine a Time. Imagine a time in America when girls get much less education than boys do, when girls' activities, especially for middle and upper class girls, are limited to ladylike endeavors, when girls and women are considered naturally weaker and inferior to boys and men, when it's considered shocking, outrageous, scandalous for a woman to give a speech in public, especially to audiences of both men and women, when women who dare to speak in public are ridiculed, reviled, threatened, even attacked, when women, especially middle and upper class women, are expected to confine their activities to a separate sphere or their home and to exhibit the virtues of religious piety, sexual purity, wifely submission, and motherly domesticity, and to always be escorted outside their home by a man. When ministers, powerful shapers of cultural norms and public opinions, vigorously promoted women's roles based on biblical verses such as, "Wives, submit yourself unto your own Lord, unto your own husband, as unto the Lord," and, "But I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over a man, but to be in silence. When a married woman does not have the legal right to her own property, enter into contracts, sign legal documents, or control what happens to her wages or her children, when women who do not get married or who have to earn money have very few job opportunities and are always paid less than a man who does the same job, when the United States government successfully pressures the Cherokee Indians to eliminate women's traditional power in making tribal decisions, when almost a million African women are held in chattel slavery, when women are not allowed to vote." Okay? Now, in writing that, if we switch into our writer's head, again, it was a matter of making some decisions. That's part of what I just read you. But I didn't have to write it that way. How about if I had moved the when? What happens then? Imagine a time in America when, and then girls get much less education than boys do. Girls' activities, especially for middle and upper class girls, are limited to ladylike endeavors. Girls and women are considered naturally weaker and inferior to boys and men. It is considered shocking, outrageous, scandalous for a woman to give a speech in public, especially to audiences of both men and women. Nothing wrong with that, right? I mean, you know, I could do that. Or what if I had done this? What if I had written it in the past tense? What if I had said, imagine a time in America when girls get much less education than boys did, when girls got much less education than boys did? Do you see? So what do you think? First, what I hope you're seeing is that words really matter, and writers really do make decisions. I wasn't interested in writing a polemical book about how badly girls were treated. I mean, you know, the polemical of, oh, here's another one about how awful. That wasn't my point, because, you know, lots of different groups have suffered all kinds of oppression. So it's not about going down that path. But it's about getting people back and thinking about that time. And then I put in a couple of other examples just because I love to do this. And you obviously don't seem to mind because you're in English literature class. But this is, there are 8 essays in Adventurous Women. And this is the first sentence from Mary Gibson Henry, who was a plant hunter extraordinary. She goes off into the wilderness. At one point, she's so far in British Columbia, she takes carrier pigeons with her so she can send messages back to her husband in Philadelphia. But the way I wrote that, the first is the first one. Mary Gibson Henry was 7 years old and on a camping trip at Moosehead Lake in Maine when she fell in love with a flower, Linnea borealis, a tiny, usually pink, bell-shaped flower born in pairs atop delicate stems that rise above a cluster of evergreen leaves. That gem of gems, Mary later recalled, awoke in me not only a love for and appreciation of the absolute perfection of the flower itself, but also for the dark, silent forest that shelters such treasures. So there are lots of things we can do with that. For example, if you look at the last sentence, that gem of gems later awoke in me not only a love for, see that where it says Mary later recalled? I could move that anywhere, couldn't I? I could put it at the end, I could put it at the middle. So that's one of the things, again, from a writerly position. And believe me, I did keep moving it around. But again, it's about cadence, it's about emphasis, it's about building momentum, building suspense. The other thing is, we could edit it. Mary Gibson fell in love with a flower, a gem of gems, she later recalled, that had woken her a love for the absolute perfection of the flower itself, but also for the dark, silent forest that sheltered some treasures. Head shaking on that one. And you also notice that I put in the Latin term for the word, the Linnea borealis, and that's to foreshadow that Mary Gibson, who marries a man named Henry, but that Mary Gibson grows up and goes on to be a highly esteemed botanist. And, you know, she knows the names, and many plants of rhododendron and azaleas are actually named after her. To sort of wrap all of this up, these are very, very brief summaries of some of what Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony's key accomplishments are that I cover in my book. First, they convinced countless people of the wisdom and truth of the then-new gospel of woman's rights. And that's a quote by the legendary Frederick Douglass, who escaped from slavery and went on to write his autobiography and become a very powerful abolitionist and orator and newspaper editor who lived in Rochester. And when Elizabeth at the Seneca Falls Convention put forth the amendment that women should ask for the vote, Frederick Douglass was the one that supported her, and then the rest of the people who were dubious, they said that was way too radical, then went along. And Frederick Douglass met Elizabeth Cady Stanton. There was a period when Elizabeth lived and Henry and the children lived in Boston. And they met at a party, at a gathering of like-minded people in probably 1844, 1845. And Frederick Douglass later said that she did the honor of sitting beside him and then convinced him by the logic of which she is master. Elizabeth was famous. You read her writing and you're just dazzled with her persuasive abilities of the wisdom and truth of the then new gospel of woman's rights. They also organized and addressed numerous women's rights conventions. And if they didn't address them, they sent letters. And these were conventions that were held all across the United States. They spearheaded a federal suffrage amendment and participated in many state campaigns, starting with two. As early as 1867, they're involved in a campaign in New York State. And when they lose that one, they jump on a train and come to Iowa. And Iowa at this time, like Nebraska, is mud roads and, you know, non-existent food, moldy, you know, nasty coffee, moldy bread, worms, Elizabeth writes about the former governor goes with her in his carriage, and at night he takes his jacket off and walks ahead so that she can drive and follow his white shirt. I mean, they're extraordinary stories of these campaigns, and which they lost, but they kept at them over and over and over again. They addressed state legislators and testified before many state and federal legislative committees over and over and over again. Both Elizabeth and Susan addressed the legislature in Nebraska. They both were here, went into the state house and addressed them, but over and over and over again. Started addressing committees of Congress in 1869 over and over again. They created an Everest-sized mountain of written material, addresses, appeals, resolutions, petitions, tracts, articles, editorials, books, leaflets, and letters galore, including what many people consider is an iconic document, Elizabeth Cady Stanton's speech that she gave in 1892, The Solitude of the South, the Declaration of Sentiments that she wrote for the Seneca Falls, the History of Woman Suffrage, which you, by the way, can buy on a CD. For $24, you can buy the CD of the History of Woman Suffrage, which is a wonderful thing to have. You can do a search for Nebraska and be prepared to come out and talk to you all, because it'll come up. They traveled and lectured in territories and states from Maine to Texas to Oregon to Louisiana year after year after year. For about a 10-year period, Elizabeth was on the road 8 months of the year, and Susan was on the road sort of endlessly. And they founded consequential organizations. The Women's Loyal National League, which they founded during the Civil War, was the organization that ran a grassroots petition campaign. And petitions are the only tool that citizens of the United States have, according to the Constitution, to advocate for a position. And it was, according to Charles Sumner, the senator who shepherded through the 13th Amendment that ended slavery, it was the petition campaign on the part of the women. 300,000 women and men signed these petitions that forced Congress to outlaw slavery in this country. They also, National Woman Suffrage Association, which became the National American Woman Suffrage Association, which after the 19th Amendment was passed, became the League of Women Voters, alive and well today. And the International Council of Women, they brought together the first meeting of women from many countries who came to Washington and met in 1888 to form groups to fight on an international level for women's rights. So their legacy is very strong, and their legacy is very powerful. And I think probably the thing that I've discovered in writing about them is that I'm having trouble letting them go. So why am I having trouble letting them go? Well, because they're extraordinary role models, and because they're inspiring, and because when Susan wrote to Elizabeth that they had spent 51 years stirring up the world, there's still a lot of stirring up to do. And we have Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and their friendship that changed the world to offer us, a model, to offer us lessons, to offer us all the things that we need to kind of take in as we continue the revolution that they started, which Elizabeth said was the greatest revolution the world has ever seen. So thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. Our guest speaker was Penny Coleman, a faculty member at Teachers College, Columbia University, and author of Where the Action Was, Women War Correspondents in World War II, Toilets, Bathtubs, Sinks, and Sewers, A History of the Bathroom, and her latest book, which was also the title of her talk, Selected Writings on Writing Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, A Friendship That Changed the World. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 27, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Susan Hart, Public Relations Specialist, and Barbara Velasquez, Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education at Metropolitan Community College, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.